Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Florida Governor Rick Scott has built his political future on job growth. This week, after 9 months without one, he hired a new lieutenant governor.
I'm proud to officially announce that Miami-Dade property appraiser Carlos Lopez Quintero will be the next Florida lieutenant governor.
Now, the property appraiser here in Miami-Dade County, Carlos Lopez Quintero, is a former state legislator. He becomes the first Hispanic and the first from Miami-Dade County to hold the job of lieutenant governor. Among his duties will be to push Governor Scott's agenda in Tallahassee, including a proposed $500 million tax cut package.
$500 million back in their pockets, that's important. Getting teachers' pay raises, that's important. Checking a box off next to my name, not so important right now. This is about them, not about any kind of definition.
How could Lopez Quintero make a difference for Governor Scott's reelection campaign this season? He promises to make the job more than ceremonial. Can he? Let us know your thoughts on the new lieutenant governor for the Sunshine State at 800-743-WLRN. Here on the Florida Roundup, you can call 800-743-9576. Email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrn.org. All one word there, thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. Live tweet us at WLRN on Facebook. And, of course, online right now, our live chat at WLRN.org. We are joined by Gina Jordan, WLRN Miami Herald correspondent in Tallahassee, and Mike Mayo back with us, columnist for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Welcome back to both of you. Gina, first of all, what kind of history did Quintero Lopez have when he served in the State House?
Well, he was term limited out, so he served his 8 years. He was well liked. He was majority leader during one of those terms. He's known as a deal maker. And he was very well liked while he was here.
Mike, well liked in Tallahassee. He came in as the county appraiser in Dade County. What does he provide Governor Scott as he moves into the heat of the election cycle?
He provides him with a Hispanic name to put under his on the ballot, which in this state, considering the growing influence of Hispanics and the Latinos, not just in South Florida, where obviously there's long been a influence, especially among the Cuban community, but in the I-4 corridor, which is basically where elections are won and lost in the state. And, it's amazing to me how much time and, energy gets devoted to talking about a lieutenant governor, considering the actual what they do on the job in their role is nothing. It is an essentially useless role. We saw how terribly government functioned without having a lieutenant governor for the last, whatever it's been, 9 months or 12 months. I mean, basically nothing has changed.
Gina, Tallahassee has been paralyzed with the lack of a lieutenant governor. Is that fair to say?
Clearly, yes. Everything has just come to a screeching halt up here.
Right, but what it is, it's a figurehead position, and it's a number two. It's if somebody's, if God forbid something happens to number one, number two is there to step in. But the main role is when it comes election time, that number two, the name is featured prominently on the ballot.
It's part of the ticket.
And Jennifer Carroll provided Governor Scott with, one, a woman, and two, a minority, an African-American. In this case, Carlos Lopez Quintero comes with, having a Hispanic surname, which can only help in a state as diverse as Florida.
But back to the point of timing here, Gina, after 9 months of no constitutional successor in the state of Florida for the chief executive position, why now?
Well, I think that this has more to do with politics than with the lawsuit that was filed. He was recently sued by an activist, Barbara Devane. We see her around the Capitol a lot. She's a lobbyist for various causes. She said that the governor should have already appointed a lieutenant governor by now, and she sued him for that, and that was recent. But I don't think that he made this decision quickly because of that lawsuit. I think that he realized that Charlie Crist is getting a lot of publicity now, and he needed to do something. And he had already had several possible lieutenant governor candidates reject him. And so he clearly needed to find someone that would get him some attention. And yeah, I think that Carlos Lopez Quintero is getting him some good attention, at least in South Florida, where he really needs it.
Well, and you mentioned some of the previous candidates maybe in private rejected an offer. Mike, what does that tell you about, I guess, what the offer is? Is it more about the lack of real protein in this kind of work, or is it a matter of the political future of the governor?
A little bit of both, yeah. And the sense that he might be radioactive, you know, politically, that there not might not be much of a future. I mean, if you go on board with a guy who's going to lose the election later this year, it doesn't look very good for yourself. But let's face facts here. This upcoming governor's battle, it's not going to be decided on the bottom of the ticket. This
right.
is going to be the top of the ticket battle. And a lot of money is going to come pouring in. It's a marquee, you know, nationwide spotlight is going to be on this Rick Scott versus Charlie Crist matchup.
So if anything, then, and I think you're right, and Gina, I would imagine you'd agree that this is really a Scott versus Crist, likely Scott versus Crist fight that we're going to have on the politics coming
no
up
question.
In
no
the
question
fall.
No question about that.
Not about lieutenant governors, not about successors. That's not going to be the big debate. But what does, I suppose, this tell us about the governing administrative style of Governor Scott? 4 years into his first into the term here, Mike.
Oh well, I mean, he's very much a CEO. I mean, in terms of he wants to run government like a business, and I guess he was comfortable with not having a CFO. Or well, I mean, we do have a state CFO technically, but I'm talking about a number two.
And a chief operating officer. But even that, I mean, it gets to the point of the job itself of lieutenant governor, as you alluded to earlier, Mike.
Yeah, it's basically to stay out of the way and not get in trouble, which is, you know, basically the cardinal rule that former lieutenant governor Carroll violated when she got embroiled in that whole mess involving arcades, the adult
the video
arcades.
Arcades,
whatever
yeah.
you want to call it.
Well, they're video arcades.
The pseudo slots parlor. So.
Gina, then, you know, as he was announced as the lieutenant governor, Lopez Quintero made it a point to say, you know, he was assured he'd have a say on policy. This wasn't just ribbon cutting and ceremonial position. How much of that can he potentially control? I believe
believe that he will be able to control that at least a little bit, because Governor Scott was looking at him not just because he was a former legislator, but also because he's a small business owner. Hmm. He's right in line with what Governor Scott is trying to do as far as let's build businesses, let's grow some jobs. And the governor, while he has said for a while that he is sort of the anti-politician, he really needs to bring in somebody who can help him understand the political circles. He struggled with the people he's appointed in his administration early on. He struggled with agency heads. He needs somebody now who understands the political circles in the legislature.
Gina Jordan, WLRN Miami Herald News in Tallahassee. Mike Mayo, South Florida Sun Sentinel, along with me. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Join the conversation at 800-743-9576. 800-743-WLRN on the telephone, online at WLRN.org, and on Twitter, use the handle at WLRN. We are starting with some state politics here, and we've got Common Core as well on the political beat. Calculus, cursive, and Common Core. This week, the Florida Department of Education proposed almost four dozen changes to the language arts and math standards known as Common Core, including calculus in high school and cursive writing in elementary school. John O'Connor is our state impact education reporter at our sister station, WUSF in Tampa, here along with us. John, characterize the magnitude of the proposed changes this week.
Well, symbolically, they look like a big deal, but in reality, there's not too much content changes there. You have the addition of calculus, but most students don't take calculus in high schools. The addition of cursive, but cursive is probably not going to show up on any of the standardized tests. It's not considered a skill that employers are looking for.
Yeah, it's tough to have. It's tough to have a bubble hole.
A lot of these changes are symbolic.
Tough to have a bubble hole multiple choice test on cursive, isn't it, Mike?
Yeah. Not only that, but these kids are taking tests on computers now, so it's really hard to write in cursive on a computer keyboard. Too.
Yeah. So, John, get behind these proposed changes, driving clarity of standards for Common Core or politically motivated?
Politically motivated for the most part. You had some complaints from folks on the political right, the political left, about the standards. And so most of these changes were in response to that. Again, most of the changes are kind of clarifying the standards, moving some things around, and they don't really affect how teachers are going to have to teach the standards come this fall.
Mike, Common Core could continue to become a significant political issue for the governor as Common Core is fully implemented. Still on schedule, I believe, John. Correct me if I'm wrong. Still on schedule to be fully implemented, K through 12 public schools in Florida, next school year, beginning in the fall of 2014. And the governor this week said, quote, "We're going to ensure these are Florida standards."
Yeah, I guess, you know, the big bugaboo now among some of the conservative crowd is, oh, gosh, federal mandates and the federal government is coming in to control our schools and what a horrible thing this is. And, you know, and I'm always amazed by the two-facedness, the hypocrisy, because when President George W. Bush was pushing No Child Left Behind as a big federal push, nobody was raising these issues. But now that it's President Obama, a Democrat in charge, all of a sudden it's, oh my gosh, you know, centralized government, big government from Washington coming in to ruin our local control of what should be, you know, decisions made at the local school board level. Look, we all need some sort of common guidelines and common standards in order to kind of raise the old level of achievement nationwide. Obviously, Florida is, you know, is part of the United States, and the United States has been lagging behind, you know, by all these statistical measures and testing, whether it's science or math. We're lagging behind other countries, and we need to raise it all overall. And I think that's why, you know, things like instituting Common Core and giving people the chance to take calculus in high school it's necessary.
It bears reminding us sometimes that California is, or excuse me, Florida. See, even I just messed it up. Florida is part of the United States as well. So thank you for that geography lesson that I had to relearn, as a matter of fact. Yeah. Speaking of geography, up in Tallahassee, Gina Jordan with WLRN Miami Herald. You know, as the legislative session begins to take some shape, this is happening, of course, on the agency side under the chief executive slot within state government. Do you anticipate much on the legislative side as Common Core is anticipated to be fully implemented with the next year?
I don't know that there's much they can do. And really, it depends on who is upset about Common Core. It seems like we've largely had Tea Party members who have been really upset about Common Core. By and large, the Republicans support Governor Scott, and Governor Scott is very actively trying to make it clear to the people who oppose this that this really is up to Florida to implement. Mm-hmm. So I don't see, John may have some other ideas about this, but right now I don't see anything big happening.
John, how about it on the legislative front?
Yeah, what you're going to see is the House has a bill that deletes all the references to Common Core from state law. They'll probably replace it with what they've been calling the Florida standards. But as we reported this week,
Is that just a change in semantics? Is that just
it's
a
absolutely
change in
semantics?
Yeah.
I mean, as we reported, State Impact, they are keeping the core of the standards. I mean, this is Common Core by another name.
Call it tomato, if you prefer.
In this case, they're taking lipstick off a pig or something like that.
We know that the education agency is set to talk about these proposed changes in the middle of February. Longer term, John, any risk of not fully implementing Common Core standards with the next school year?
The standards, they'll be in place. The question is whether the testing will be in place. You know, it's scheduled to be used early 2015.
Yeah.
They're going to make that decision about what test to use probably in March. There's questions about whether schools are going to have the technology ready, you know, whether there'll be a pen and paper option as well. So it seems unlikely, based on everything that the State Department of Education has said, that this thing is not going to go ahead according to schedule. What may change are some pieces related to it, like teacher evaluations or school grades or things like that may get some tweaking or some delays or things like that.
John O'Connor, State Impact Education Reporter here on the Florida Roundup from WUSF in Tampa. Thank you, John. In the first half of last year, more than 40 kids under the watch of the Florida Department of Children and Families died. Now, this horror led to leadership resignations. It led to state hearings. It led to a scathing report on this agency's what was called a systemic failure. This week, Governor Scott proposed adding $40 million to the agency's budget, money to hire additional people with the goal of reducing the number of child protective cases that each investigator is responsible for. Let's discuss it now with the Florida Roundup crew, Gina Jordan in Tallahassee and Mike Mayo here in Miami. Gina, is this new funding going to make much of an operational difference with the agency?
I don't see that happening right now. Governor Scott has so much to deal with this department. So much is going to be happening during the session. I think you're going to see a lot of bills, people trying to make changes. But he's got to find somebody to put in charge of this agency to begin with, who will stay in place and make the changes that are needed. He's been struggling with finding somebody who can stay in and get the job done.
Mike, does this go to the magnitude of the challenges for this agency director?
Yes, but the thing is, these challenges are perennial.
Right.
And that's the sad part is, you know, now we're talking about whatever the latest tragedy du jour is. But, you know, you go back to the names, Rilia Wilson, and, you know, that was 10 years ago. And then that whole awful, the Barahona twins down here in Miami, and that was, what, 5 years ago. Something terrible always happens because, you know, and it shouldn't. I mean, it has to, but when you're dealing with basically always you're going to be dealing with kids that are in bad situations, going from one bad situation maybe to a foster home, which might be just as bad. But, you know, obviously there has to be proper oversight, proper monitoring, proper, you know, guidelines in place to make sure that kids are being monitored, that caseworkers are actually going and showing up and doing the things they're supposed to do and not taking shortcuts. I think some of this funding will help because if you're putting more people on the job, if you have more bodies and they're better paid and they're more likely to stay and there's not as much turnover, and if you don't have as big a caseloads, there's not that, I guess, incentive to maybe cut corners or maybe they physically can't get to 20 different locations right in one day. That's the part that can help. But, you know, I'm afraid that no matter what happens, you know, because given the nature of what's in the system, I hate to be defeatist, but I think there's always going to be a certain number of bad results, and it's just a matter of avoiding the ones that really can be avoided.
The interim DCF secretary, Esther Jacobo, has been optimistic about the response that she's initially been getting about some additional help from the state legislature.
I'm new to this. You know, I've only been secretary since July, right? But every conversation I've had with legislators, all I hear from them is, how can we help?
So, Gina, how does this debate go beyond this this cycle that Michael highlights of paying kind of lip service at the state capitol about having to do more but actually doing more, and the volatility in funding that this agency has seen under the Scott administration?
I think that, you know, Mike pretty much nailed it. It is going to take money, and it's going to take leadership. Unfortunately, Esther Jacobo, who is well-liked in this position and seems to be doing a good job by all accounts, but she's not staying. She's only the interim, and she's leaving after the session.
Right.
There will be some legislation proposed during the session that will involve money, for example, but I think it's going to be a long process. And ultimately, it does come down to getting the right people in there, enough people who are not overworked, who will actually go and check on these kids.
Tough job, to some degree a thankless job day in and day out, except for those small wins that you get, which do not, unfortunately, always make the headlines, and you don't want them to make the headlines, certainly. Gina Jordan with WLRN Miami Herald News in Tallahassee. Mike Mayo with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Plenty more to come. You can join this conversation online on Twitter at WLRN and our live chat ongoing right now at WLRN.org. Still ahead, Miami Beach scratches the billion-dollar plan to redevelop its convention center, while Broward County changes how it pays to fix up neighborhoods. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. The Miami Beach Convention Center has been the center of a long debate over how to bring it up to modern convention standards. 6 months after selecting a master development team to design and build a project, this week the City Commission threw it out. Does the convention center need a fix? Does it need a hotel? Can the neighborhood handle additional traffic? Let us know your thoughts on email, thefloridaroundup@wlrn.org. On the telephone, 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, or on the live chat at WLRN.org. Mike Mayo, South Florida Sun Sentinel, still with us. Christina Vega from the Miami Herald, along with us as well. Christina, you've been covering this convention center debate for a long time. It was a bit of a election issue this past fall in 2013. Why did the city decide after 6 months to cease negotiations with the master development plan team?
Well, I wouldn't say it was a little election issue. It was a pretty big
election issue.
It was
maybe
a pretty big election issue. In the November election, voters elected basically almost a whole new commission, and a lot of the new commissioners were opposed to the kind of grand scale plan that had been advanced by not only the previous commission, but a previous city manager. The original plan encompassed 52 acres, and it was kind of a redevelopment of the whole neighborhood, not just the convention center. The other thing is, industry leaders say that a headquarter hotel is needed to make the area, to make the convention center more competitive. So during the election, there was a debate about whether the plan was too big, too expensive, whether the neighborhood really wanted it. Miami Beach is really small, so you have on top of each other residents and commercial and all these different competing interests. And so the new mayor and commission, who again questioned the plan during the election, decided that this isn't the plan that residents want and we need to start over. However, they all agree that it's important to renovate the convention center because it's an economic driver for the area. So they hope that by doing this, the renovation part will actually get done.
The issue remains, right? The issue remains fixing the convention center, bringing it up to modern convention standards so it can compete not only locally, regionally, nationally, and of course globally. We interviewed the Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine for our If I Were Mayor project, talking just about this particular issue.
One of the first things I plan to do is get that renovation, that convention center project, back on track. It may not be what was originally planned, but we can get the same thing done, maybe downscaled quite a bit, that's more in line with the neighborhood, where we don't lease our property or transfer our property anyway.
So, Christina, you're nodding your head a lot. That's essentially what he pledged to do on WLRN and what the commission agreed to do to some degree this week.
Right. So they agreed to basically put out a new bid for people to come in and propose how they can renovate the convention center.
But have they scaled down what they want out of that bid? In other words, is the door still open for a 52-acre master redevelopment plan of the entire neighborhood?
Well, the bid has not been drawn up yet, but it's very unlikely that it will be as expansive as the previous one. What's going to happen is the city is going to develop the bid, and then it's got to come back to the commission, and they have to approve it.
What's at stake?
Well, that depends on who you talk to. industry leaders, people who sell the convention centers, say that we need to do this and we need to do this quickly or we're going to lose business. And already people have pulled out because this was kind of, you could foresee this during the election that things were going to be changing. If you speak to some residents, though, they say that we don't want this and we don't need this. Miami Beach doesn't need to attract such large conventions, that we're kind of a boutique city and we can survive off of the things like Art Basel.
Mm-hmm. Well, and is Art Basel threatened if the convention center is not renovated?
The mayor said at the last meeting that he was actually working, or the city was actually working along with Art Basel. And I believe that last time they were in town, they said that they were sticking around.
So I guess that's
all we know about that.
Sticking around until the next time, perhaps. Those negotiations certainly are very vibrant. Christina Vega covering Miami Beach for the Miami Herald, helping us out here on the Florida Roundup. Mike Mayo also along with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Of course, convention planning and the economic anticipation of the kind of business that can bring is not exclusive to Miami Beach. Out in Sunrise, there's been talk about how to draw in more convention space, more tourists to the BB&T Center beyond the Billy Joel concerts and the other concerts, and of course the Florida Panthers, the National Hockey League team.
Yeah, well, the Panthers are the main primary tenant at the Sunrise Arena, which is, I guess, now called the BB&T Center. I can't keep track of all the different corporate names, but basically this building was built by the county for the Panthers in the late 90s, and now the Panthers are coming around with helmets and hand, asking for a renegotiation of the lease so that they would pay less towards the repayment of the construction bonds. Right now, they're on the hook for about $4.5 million a year. That's on their end. And they want the county to pick up that tab from the bed tax that's being generated from, I guess it's when they originally decided to build the arena, they approved a 2% hotel bed tax that was going to be used to fund it. The county currently pays $8 million a year towards the arena bonds,
mm-hmm.
and the Panthers want them to add on that $4.5 million because, hey, you know, over the course of time, there's been more hotels and yep. the room rates have gone up, so that kitty has grown. It's now about almost $17 million a year. It started off at only $8 million, so there's a lot left over, but that leftover could be going towards beach renourishment, which is going to be a pressing priority as the sea levels rise and there's more storms, and also it could be going towards just the tourist marketing and the greater convention and visitors bureau, which goes out and tries to get tourists down here, especially in the cold winter months.
And it could go for the redevelopment of additional accommodations. It could go for the redevelopment of that center. It could go for the redevelopment of more economic activity geared toward attracting and housing and entertaining more tourists.
Right. And what the Panthers are trying, their pitch is, hey, we do bring tourists. Even if it's not, you know, sometimes the occasional hockey crowd that people come in, I think that's a little bit of a stretch because the people that are coming to hockey games are largely tourists or snowbirds who are going to be here anyway, and yeah. they come and see their team, whether it's the New York Rangers or the Montreal Canadiens.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but the Panthers are trying to say, hey, because we've upgraded this building, we've got a Jehovah's Witness convention coming this summer. We're getting the NHL draft again in 2015. We do stimulate out-of-state tourism with this building, so please come invest some more in it. It's worth it for you. I don't know if the commission is going to go for it. Most commissioners have been pretty amenable to the Panthers in the past, but there seems to be a lot of pushback from the public on this one since the idea has been floated, and I'm pretty opposed to it as a columnist. I just think it's the worst form of corporate welfare because basically what we're doing is subsidizing wealthy athletes and owners.
Yeah.
You know, hockey, they still make a good pretty penny even though it's the last of the major sports.
The Panthers may still be dealing with the ashes not only of the Sun Life Stadium failure to get the support for that kind of renovation, but of course the Marlins Park building.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even though it's a different county and different politicians, the people here in the region know all about what happened with the
news
Marlins.
Travels, Mayo. News
yeah.
travels.
Yeah,
right?
There is no moat at the county line when it comes to the news. We all find out about it. So yeah, they're going to be confronting the anti-Marlins stigma.
Yeah, but one other industry that has been involved at least on the sidelines of BB&T and some of the possibility of developing in and around that area is the gaming industry.
Yeah. The Panthers have actually partnered with Boyd Gaming. It's a Las Vegas outfit that used to own Dania High Line. They recently sold that property, but Boyd Gaming is still partnered with the Panthers in order to explore the development of a hotel/casino property. And it's something that's on the pipeline, just the same way that Genting is now partnering with Gulfstream, looking to maybe use one of their parimutuel permits yeah. as a way to maybe expand or get slot machines, at least in downtown Miami. It would take some, I guess, changes in law and administrative rulings. But, you know, they're both of them, you see this more and more where people are partnering. And talking about the Miami Beach Convention Center, wasn't it a few years ago where casino magnate Steve Wynn was down there looking mm-hmm. around saying, this would be a great place to develop a convention center hotel/resort/casino, but obviously in Miami Beach, politicians there have been pretty averse to gaming and gambling, and I think the Fountain Blue people would say, hey, we're here first. Why don't you give us the casino license?
There's been no talk of that in this redevelopment plan, right?
No. At a couple of debates during the election, candidates were asked, and one of the candidates responded to the question of gambling in Miami Beach by saying, that's a non-issue here. We all realize it's dead, but who knows?
You never know. Things have a way of roaring back to life when there's a lot of money at stake.
And there is a lot of money at stake. And some of it, yes, is kind of domestic resident money, but a lot of it is tourist money. Governor Scott, at an event this week that I attended and I saw him speak, said 85 tourists visiting the state of Florida equal one job. 85 tourists equal one job. And he is proposing a significant increase in the money for Visit Florida, which, of course, is the tourist arm, to attract that kind of import into the state of Florida. So, you know, as the Miami Beach debate is now roaring kind of back to life here, Christina, you know, what's is the tone, if the tone of that debate, has that changed now that the politics to some degree are settled?
I would not say that the politics are settled in this.
Maybe the politicians have settled into their seats.
I think that emotions are still high. I think the tone, from the beginning, it's been a debate as to, you know, what's appropriate to put there. And that debate is still continuing. Miami Beach has a very active community activist group. And you know, so they demand this kind of debate, really.
This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. That's Christina Vega from the Miami Herald, Mike Mayo from the South Florida Sun-Sentinel along with us. Join the conversation about tourism and development at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. While Miami Beach debates its convention center, Broward County potentially is on the cusp of debating the BB&T Center. The county is changing how rundown neighborhoods can pay for fix-ups. Community redevelopment agencies traditionally are funded by property taxes from specific neighborhoods. The idea is money is earmarked to stay in those neighborhoods to help fix them up. But this week, the county commission in Broward County changed that strategy. Mike, it's a bit complex, but follow through with us here on the changes that are to come for these agencies.
Well, it's very complex, and there's no change right away. But what's happening is these CRAs, as they're called, basically what it does is divert money that would otherwise be going to the county, property tax money, keeps them in the particular city and municipality when they designate a CRA zone. And in order to get that designation, and it's by state statute, an area has to be known as blighted. What's happened is, you know, they establish these CRAs and they usually last for 25 or 30 years.
Yeah.
The whole bunch of them are going to be coming up for renewals. And what the county is saying, not so fast. We're not going to automatically rubber stamp the renewals. And in fact, we want to basically have more control countywide to say what area needs redeveloped. It's basically going to be a fight between the cities and the county over who controls the money kitty. And the cities are going to be very reluctant to give that up. But it's funny. Has there been abuse? Absolutely. You look at some places like the Gulfstream Park area in Hallandale. That's part of a CRA. You walk around Gulfstream, it's the furthest thing from blight
than
you think of.
That's a blighted neighborhood?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So there has been, you know, the way that, and again, blight is never specifically spelled out in the statute, so they could make a blighted area out of anything and keep that money. And it's going to be a prolonged fight, food fight between cities and the counties. And it's also going to have to get the legislature involved because they're the ones who wrote the statute.
Well, we're talking about some of these community redevelopment agencies in Pompano Beach and Fort Lauderdale are the ones that are nearest expiration and I suppose the most threat of losing control of this money. But you've got Margate, Lauderdale Lakes, Davie, Plantation, Hollywood, Hallandale Beach, Deerfield. It stretches all around, of course, Broward County. And does it pit the cities against county government? Is this a fight for financial control, but is there any thing, you know, beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fight for financial control because the county wants to have as much control. This money would otherwise be coming to them if there was no designation.
And it would go to the general,
to the general fund.
It could go to parks, and that's the county's argument. We got parks to pay for. We've got bus drivers to pay. We've got all the sewers to build, all these other things that this money could be going to help the entire county as opposed to being captured by these so-called blighted areas.
Right. And look, some of the CRAs are in really blighted areas, but then again, you haven't seen many changes in them. I'm thinking of in Fort Lauderdale, that Sistrunk corridor, where the CRA has been there for a long time. They've bought up a lot of parcels, but you don't see the redevelopment because, again, the private sector is very leery about coming into certain areas that truly are blighted.
This is kind of relevant to the Miami Beach Convention Center because the city was hoping or relying on an extension of CRA over there to help pay for the renovation of the convention center. Now the mayor says that we don't need to rely on that money. We're just going to use what we have. That might be because the county might be reluctant now to extend the CRA now that they're starting all over.
And so does this put potentially more of the general fund money in Miami Beach with the redevelopment of the convention center at quote unquote at risk or in play?
I don't know. The mayor says that they've got money from, for example, a special tax that voters approved, a hotel tax, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. But I don't think the general fund would be used.
This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. George from Miami joins the conversation. George, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Go ahead.
I'm a realtor here in Miami, and the last time that the National Association of Realtors met was in 1993 that they came to Miami. And the experience was so bad that the association kind of blacklisted Miami Beach or Miami in general as a place, because at that time we didn't have enough hotel rooms. So obviously, if we remodel the convention center, the piece of having hotels near the convention center is extremely important. We do conventions in Orlando, in San Francisco, in New Orleans, because hotels are near the convention center. It's absurd to have a convention center that doesn't have enough hotel facilities. 20,000 members attend our national meetings. And as I heard in the conversation, 85 jobs are generated every time you get a tourist in this area. Plus, having realtors from not only from the United States, but from all over the world, it would showcase not only Miami Beach, but the region in general.
George, so joining the conversation here on the Florida Roundup. Mike, go ahead.
No, he hit the nail on the head because, you know, Miami, we're not competing against, it's not Miami versus Broward, it's the whole country.
Yeah,
and there's other areas that have set up better. I mean, if we were starting from scratch and building a convention center today in this area in Miami, would it be on the barrier island, Miami Beach,
right,
where it's hard to get to, where the transit isn't real good, or would it be more downtown where there's a lot of big hotels around there? And again, another problem is here in the wintertime, any convention that comes in, you're competing against all these snowbirds and people that want to be here that are going to be paying top dollar at these hotel rooms, and you can't cut the conventions a break on the hotel rooms at peak season. And in off-peak season, you always have the threat of hurricanes looming, and who wants to bring a hurricane here in the middle of August?
Well,
a convention in the middle of August.
Let's not import any of that bad weather,
yeah,
certainly. But Christine, I mean, the hotel debate really is about an economic opportunity versus an opportunity lost or the opportunity cost, right? So if you've got a hotel with several hundred rooms, is that going to generate additional activity, or perhaps could it replace the activity because of the congestion that it brings, and perhaps take business away from the boutique hotels, and thus they'll have to lower their prices and accept lower revenue?
The hotel component of this is probably the most controversial. You have people on both sides of the issue. It is important to note that since the caller has been here in 1993, there's been a lot of hotel construction in Miami Beach.
Yeah.
However, Miami Beach's hotels are very expensive, as you mentioned. And there's an argument that because our hotels are so expensive, we should go after certain types of conventions and meetings, you know, things that bring doctors together and people in technology who have the money to spend and don't mind.
Yeah, maybe it's not the 20,000 plus conventions, but the 2,000 plus conventions.
Exactly.
Yeah. Christina Vega covering Miami Beach for the Miami Herald. Mike Mayo with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Stay close. Plenty more to come on the program. Changing the way aid agencies do business in Haiti 4 years after the earthquake, and the future of the Coconut Grove Playhouse. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
We have to change the way we do business in Haiti. We need to see more of our assistance funding go to both the Haitian government and to Haitian organizations. We cannot sustain this paradigm of donors like the United States providing medical care to Haitians.
That's John Gruark. He's USAID Mission Director, speaking with WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett this week, 4 years after the devastating earthquake in Haiti, changing the way aid agencies do business in Haiti. That's our topic here right now on the Florida Roundup with Tim Padgett with WLRN and Jackie Charles with the Miami Herald joining us from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Jackie, first of all, tell us about what you're seeing on the ground here. What are the conditions like in Haiti 4 years after the devastating quake?
4 years after the earthquake, life is definitely returning, I mean, to Haiti. People are living. I mean, that was the message of President Michel Martelly, telling people, Haitians, that they should not just exist, they should live. And you see that plazas or public parks where there were tents, there are now kids playing football, people, I'm sorry, soccer, but football here in Haiti. People are jogging, people are studying, there is activity. But at the same time, there are still people in tents. There are basically more than 100,000. And in particular, there's one community, Kana'a, which is on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince, that the U.S. had a lot to do with. And today you have anywhere between 54,000 and 250,000 people that are living in tents and shanties and in cinder block homes. So I heard that clip, and it's very interesting when you hear the position.
How does that resonate on the ground in Haiti with the agencies doing business there? When the mission director for USAID says point blank, current practices are unsustainable.
Well, the reality is that this is something that aid agencies, Haitian organizations, have long called on the United States government to do. This has been the biggest criticism, whether it's been in Haiti or any other country, in terms of the number of projects and dollars that go to non-organizations in that particular country. I think in the case of Haiti after the quake, the USAID has been criticized on the construction of homes, and in particular Kana'a, which I mentioned. It was at the insistence of the United States government that former President René Préval was told to declare that land public utility. And he was told it was, quote-unquote, a deal-breaker if he didn't do it. The fears then, which are starting to emerge now, is that it would become a slum. And so 4 years later, after the quake, you've got all of these people that are living there, and it is not close to that, depending on, you know, who you speak to, but there is an effort the government is saying now that they want to prevent it from becoming a slum, but there is a recognition by everyone that it's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. And I too have spent a lot of time in Kana'a in the past few years. And what you find is that it's sort of a model. And Jackie, tell me if you would agree with this as well, that it's sort of a laboratory where you see, on the one hand, you know, the sort of standard international aid organization, non-governmental organization, NGO, that is sort of, you know, bogged down in all of the red tape and doesn't get as much done as you feel they should. But then there are some other aid organizations there that have done really innovative things. One comes to mind, a group from Chile called Un Techo para mi País, which means a roof for my country. And they know how to get through the red tape. And you see organizations like this that are actually out, you know, building a lot more homes than other organizations. And you wonder, why aren't agencies like USAID doing more business with them rather than these more sort of, you know, standard aid organizations that seem to get the lion's share of the cash?
Is it the lack of innovation, Jackie, that USAID has because it's a more institutional, I guess, more established?
Well, no, I have to caution you because there are a number of aid agencies that did build homes, but today they do not have papers for their homes. I remember meeting a very nice Italian nun who built a number of houses in City Soleil. And when I asked her about how did she manage to get the land, and she told me she just took it. There's another aid agency in the same area of Kana'a, and there was an NGO that did the same thing. And today that's a complaint to some of these homeowners. I mean, there are rules and you have to do it. And yes, USAID has been bogged down by that. But the fact that USAID, for instance, built less than 14,000 homes they promised because the Haitian government insisted that there should be flush toilets. And they had to, and the price went up. You have to say at the end of the day, if you're going to give me something, should it not be better than what I had before? But money is not endless. So I think that's a very interesting debate, very interesting question.
Jackie Charles from the Miami Herald with us from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Let's continue the conversation. Gordon joins us from Davie. And Gordon, you have some personal experience dealing with the rebuilding of that country, don't you?
Well, extensively, yes, from many viewpoints. But again, let's keep in mind that it's not Haiti entirely. We're speaking generally about Pétionville, Port-au-Prince, Guadeloupe, Léogan, and the interim areas of the Carrefour and Bizoton that were blighted by the earthquake.
Tell us about your experience about a family-run hotel and your assessment 4 years after and the ability for large aid organizations to make a difference.
The family-run hotel, actually, it was... Put it this way, it was knocked down by the quake. What remained of it had to be destroyed in order to comply with insurance, to reinsure it. Mm-hmm. And it's all been rebuilt, and it's doing very, very well. We're at about 100% occupancy right now until the end of the month. And this is owing to the Jazz Festival in Haiti that is is annually at this time of the year.
Well, congratulations on the reestablishment of that business in Haiti. Angel joins us as well here on the Florida Roundup. Angel, go ahead.
Hello. Yes, this is Angel Aloma speaking.
Yes, this is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Go ahead.
I'm the executive director of Food for the Poor, and I've just returned from Haiti. And I have to agree in some ways and not agree in others. I have seen a lot of things changing about Haiti. I visit there very frequently. And, for example, you know, there is no debris in the city that is very visible like how it was. The city has been cleared. There is the cleanest I have seen the capital in many, many years. We have been doing a tremendous amount of work there also, but the roads are improving. The road from Cap-Haitien to Port-au-Prince is a dream compared to what it was. You know, it was kind of like a riverbed before. So things are, you know, slow as always, mm-hmm. but they're happening. You know, we ourselves have built 4,364 permanent two-room concrete block homes since the earthquake. We have restored or built, we built six huge schools in Port-au-Prince and restored many others. So we have a total of 30 schools in Port-au-Prince that we have gotten back to work. We have shipped 4,076 containers of gifts in kind and purchase items. We have installed 71 water filtration systems that are solar powered and that each one do 10,000 gallons of water per day, chlorinated and purified. And we have signed an agreement now with the Fonds d'Assistance Économique et Sociale in Haiti, to with the IDB also as partners, to do 1,000 homes in the northern corridor that are both hurricane and earthquake proof. And when I say that, it's not that they may not crack, but the structure will not fall.
Yeah, up to modern standards. Angel Aloma with Food for Poor joining us here on the Florida Roundup, talking about the rebuilding of Haiti and some of the difficulties, obviously, that continue 4 years on. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
I dreamed there was an Emperor Antony. His face was as the heavens, and therein stuck a sun and moon, which kept their course and lighted the little o' the earth.
Most sovereign creature.
His legs bestrid the ocean. His reared arm crested the world. His voice was propertied as all the tunid spheres, and that to friends. But when he meant to quail and shake the orb, he was as rattling thunder.
Cleopatra.
Think you there was, or might be such a man as this I dreamed of.
A new production of Antony and Cleopatra with a South Florida twist, a unique South Florida and Caribbean twist. Christine DiMatte from WLRN is with us here on the Florida Roundup. What is that twist?
Oh, first, play more of that. I just
you could listen all day long,
that.
Couldn't you?
I can. The twist is that this production brings together Miami's own Gable Stage with two of the top producers internationally of classical theater. That would be the Royal Shakespeare Company. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever been an actor or know actors, you know that just the prospect of working with that troupe
company
makes you quake in your boots, okay? And the other one is the Public Theater from New York City. And this is a production that just raises Gable Stage's profile enormously.
And selected to set in 18th century Haiti.
Yes, interesting choice.
Tell us about that choice.
Well, Miami-raised playwright Terrell McCraney was asked to do this like bold re-edit of Antony and Cleopatra. It's a very, very difficult play to mount. It's a mm-hmm. difficult play to do. I spoke to Terrell. He said the reason that he said it here was because he was raised in Miami. He felt that this setting was something that Miami audiences could respond to, that they could have a true conversation about in whole. So he's acquainted with Haitian history.
And lots of news in arts, certainly this week. The Coconut Grove Playhouse, the long-blighted blue monster on the main highway there, may have a new lease on life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this production figures prominently in that, because since Gable Stage's profiles is being raised, Gable Stage figures prominently in this because Miami-Dade County has wanted for a long time to make Gable Stage the preeminent regional theater in Miami, housed at Coconut Grove.
Yeah, and the ownership was cleared up this week of the Playhouse.
This week, thank heavens. Thank heavens.
So many years that's been confused, and we'll continue following that story with Christine DiMatte here on WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup for Friday, January 17th. More tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. and online at WLRN.org. The program produced by Elaine Chin and Alicia Zuckerman, Public Insight Network, Steph Farrow, Executive Producer Peter J. Mayer. Stay tuned, South Florida Arts.